This is the Voice of Freedom.
Do you really understand what this country is all about?
This is our manifesto. This is our rallying cry. This is our reply.
There is absolutely no evidence to support the statement that we're the greatest country in the world.
Today it's time to stop singing and start swinging.
You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
You want to claim this land is a land of the free? Then the symbol of your country cannot just be a flag.
Yep. I've said it before and I'll say it again. Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around every once in a while. You can miss it.
All right, now you sons of bitches. You know how I feel.
What's up, Hep Cadets, cats, and kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. And today's episode finds me perplexed, listeners. So typically what we do here, I think everyone is generally speaking familiar with the show. And actually, before I get started on a rant, I should say that if you are a fan of what we do here and you'd like to support the show and become a member of the Hep Cult, you can do so at www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. And there's a few different reward tiers for you there, a few different payment options, and you can support the cause. Back to what I was saying, though. So what we typically do here is I have a subject that ties into a general overall point that this show is making, which I'm not going to state outright because I'd like you to learn along with me. But I have a stated objective for the show and a series of large, broader topics that I choose smaller bits and pieces from that form a broader framework, right? And there's typically, because a lot of those things draw from, in particular, even the UFO stuff usually draws from, you know, anti-communist literature from the Cold War, really old goddamn conspiracy theories, sometimes from the 15 to 1700s, the 19th century spiritualist movement, neo-Nazism, Eastern esotericism, the history of anti-communist political conspiracy, the Cold War, those kinds of things. Or the history of the Patriot Militia, movement in the United States, the sort of proto-fascist movement that started here in the 1940s, but really the 1920s, and to a lesser extent, the labor movement. Those are sort of things that I cover, right? And to an extent, all of these things tie together in various ways. And there's lots of literature on most of these subjects, because they've been around for a really long time, and that's one of the points of the show, right, is that a lot of these things, when you look around America today at things like MAGA, Stop the Steal, January 6th, QAnon, the goddamn fucking lunatics running for office, the burgeoning fascist creep, the militia movement, all of these sorts of things. When you look at this stuff, and I hear people say it all the time, this is all new and how did it get like this? Well, it's not new, actually. All of this has sort of been building slowly, if not surely, for hundreds of years. It's all part of a tradition in this country, and we're learning about that tradition a little bit at a time. A lot of it comes from what I've taken to coining as the neo-Volkish movement, this sort of a weaponization of American exceptionalism, American folklore, conspiracy culture, alternative news media, and hyper-conservative, far-right, nativist extremism, and kind of like rolled up into a ball and thrown at the world. There's those things that you can look at, but all of that is rooted in older stuff. You know, none of it's actually new. In fact, it's interesting, especially if you have any sort of an interest in, you know, a lot of what we've talked about in the past, the sort of emergence of the militia patriot right in the 80s and 90s. If you go back and look at footage from Waco or Ruby Ridge or any of these standoffs, the people standing there protesting for the Second Amendment rights of whoever happens to be beefing with the ATF that day look exactly the same as the people going to Stop the Steal rallies today. The only difference is the red hats give them a uniform. Other than that, this group of people has existed in this country in some form of fashion for a very, 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 very long time. And as such, studying them isn't, I mean, it's laborious because there is a lot to read, but there is usually shit to read. The problem with today's subject, the secret space program, is that there isn't really much literature because most of the people in this are such obvious con artists or batshit crazy people. No one would publish books if they wrote them unless they're self-published, which, okay, in the case of David Wilcock, who the fuck knows how many books that motherfucker wrote. But usually these are self-promoted people. It's a very fringe, well, it's not fringe, is it, though? Because what you notice, and there's a way to relate this, I think, for those of you who are regular listeners of the show. Last season, when we talked about the Tea Party movement, we really sort of explained how the Tea Party, over time, not in any sort of an I wouldn't necessarily say intentional way, but how the Tea Party gradually became the MAGA movement politically. That if you look at the faces that were involved in the Tea Party movement, they're all staunch Trump supporters now, right? In much the same way, the secret space program, which as a thing is kind of hard to pin down because it's not so much a thing as it is a farm culture for science fiction spacey weirdos, it's gradually kind of just become QAnon. And I mean, it still exists, but in so much as the secret space program has laid the groundwork for what would become the deep state conspiracy, it's very easy for these people who grift from the secret space program to multitask and grift from QAnon. Because as we've discussed in the past, the reptilians exist in this space. A lot of the Illuminati conspiracies, and a lot of those have extraterrestrial ties through things like Gaia TV, which we're going to talk about a bit today. There's a strong cross-section of New Age and the QAnon-adjacent conspiratorial right wing now. All of these things kind of confluence together in QAnon, and it's the secret space program provides a lot of the groundwork for. There's a lot of shit involving dark money that we're not aware of. Now, the problem with researching this stuff is it's not a solid narrative. It's not a specific conspiracy. It's not an event. It's like a proving ground for people who want to sling sci-fi bullshit at the wall and see if they can build an audience. I mean, we have everyone from Laura Eisenhower, the allegedly the great-granddaughter of Dwight D. Eisenhower, which is ironic because he's alleged to have met with aliens like four goddamn times. And she claims to have been part of the secret space program and has 6.5 hour YouTube videos and videos on Gaia TV and in other places about how she was, as a child, induced into things like fighting reptilian aliens on Mars and time travel and teleportation and every other goddamn thing. And, of course, there is David Wilcock, who... fucking, it's impossible to do anything on this show that doesn't come back to Theosophy. We'll talk about him in greater detail in a bit, but David Wilcock, who if you're a fan of Ancient Aliens, it's probably worth noting he is a regular commentator on that show, and David Wilcock's pedigree is based on the fact that he believes himself to be the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce. So that is two people on that show, him and David Icke, both, who I know for a fact, part of their pedigree as ufologists is tied to, in David Icke's case, the fact that he thinks that he's Space Jesus, and in David Wilcock's case, the fact that he believes that he is the reincarnation of a Christian clairvoyant from the 18th or 19th century who would fall asleep and... diagnose people's physical and mental ailments. They call him a sleeping prophet. It's a very interesting story, actually. But that two people on Ancient Aliens who are, you know, wearing suits and ties and presented as, you know, quasi-academic experts in the field of, you know, theoretical science or whatever the fuck you want to call that they do on that bullshit show. Both of them believe themselves to essentially be reincarnated savior figures. And that's just a show that's on television that gets to tell you that, you know, the Egyptians didn't build the pyramids, aliens did. So that's interesting. And this whole fucking, I don't know what to call it, honestly, whether you'd call it a movement or a space, whatever the fuck, the secret space program attracts tons of people like this because it's an offshoot of New Age in a way. Of course, UFO culture is intrinsically fucking tied to New Age in so many unfortunate ways. So this idea of people who have channeled extraterrestrials for secret knowledge about bases on Mars and fucking, forgotten colonies that we have been communicating with since the 1970s. You know, Bob Lazar comes up today. That's another thing. It's going to be a bit loose because, like I said, there's no written record of any of this shit. It's all videos and here, buy my book, and I'm not giving David Wilcock money for anything. He can go fuck himself. So the notes are a bit loose. So the delivery is going to be a bit loose. So in a way, while this is also the secret space program, it's kind of like a Mock Speaks part two, because we're going to talk a little bit while we discuss a lot of this stuff about kind of my history and trajectory within conspiracy culture, which is sort of part of what laid the groundwork for this show, albeit a while ago. Because a big one for me, which kind of comes up as part of the secret space program, is the idea that the moon landing was faked. And I believed that up until, fuck, maybe 6 or 7 years ago? Something like that. And I've alluded to since the beginning of this show that part of my relationship to the material, in addition to being someone who grew up with Uncle Bill, I have a tendency towards conspiratorial thinking. I have a history of endorsing a lot of conspiracies. I think the two most prominently, because I never like to go all in on this is definitely what happened, because we don't really know. But I was very, very confident in the 9/11 truther movement until, again, like probably 6, 7, maybe like 6 or 7 years ago, and that the moon landing, at least the first one, didn't really happen. I got better, but it was a thing for a very, very long time with me. And I'll talk a bit about what convinced me of the lack of validity of those conspiracies. And we'll talk a bit about fucking space weirdos, man. What are you going to do? It's literally just nonsense. All of this is nonsense. And honestly, most of the groundwork for this nonsense is stuff that we've covered on the show before. Things like the Men in Black, the Roswell conspiracy, of course, Majestic 12. A lot of the groundwork that these people built their houses of garbage on, we've already talked about. So if you are a regular listener, you're going to have an easier time with a lot of this stuff, because I'll explain a bit, but I don't feel like it's necessary to take up a ton of time rehashing things, more than we already do, because let's be honest, all of this stuff is interconnected. But it should be fun. I'm kind of thinking of this as the spiritual successor to the Brief History of American Fascism, and that this is kind of like a brief history of American space weirdos. Let's have at it. Here we go.
We've come to this planet looking for intelligent life. Oops, we made a mistake.
While, like I said, there isn't really a flat, quote-unquote, secret space program conspiracy, the gist of it is that NASA has a secondary program funded by dark money that either works with other an alien federation in outer space, is attempting to colonize Mars, is kidnapping children and sending them to Mars as food for our lizard overlords. There's a lot of different versions of it, but the basic gist of the conspiracy is NASA is up to some shit we don't know about, and that's sort of founded in the idea that Apollo 17 was the last moon landing because we encountered hostile extraterrestrials when we went to the moon. Now, this is also tied into the idea that we didn't go to the moon when we said we did, which is always been something that I've kind of personally believed. I've dissuaded myself of this idea, but for a long time, I believed that because we were involved in the space race with the Soviet Union, and it looked as though they may win that space race, we manufactured footage saying we had gone to the moon before we actually went to buy ourselves more time to actually get there. This seemed like a plausible thing to me, and there's enough bullshit about Stanley Kubrick and other things available on the internet and in books, and the kind of weird conspiracy circles that you used to travel in if you were in any way familiar with Bill Cooper or internet messaging boards back in the 90s and early 2000s, to validate this thought process for me. And as was sort of the case with all of the conspiracies that I believed, what ultimately dissuaded me of this belief was something that Michael Barkin suggests. There's a name for it. It's a principle. But basically, you can prove whether something is true or not based on the number of people that would have to be able to maintain a lie in order for that cover-up to continue to happen. And in the case of the moon landing, thousands of people were involved in that process. So the idea that thousands of people, and not just people, thousands of government employees could keep their mouths shut for decades is highly unlikely. And you can really verify this proof by saying there are a number of times when the government has attempted to cover things up, and we know about them because they suck at covering things up. Now, where you really have to watch yourself is whenever you tell yourself that sometimes they let things get out because they want you to think that they're incompetent, but the reality is that they're actually very, very good at this stuff to the point that they make you think that they're bad at it. You have to watch that kind of thinking. But if you can keep a lid on that, then it's reasonable to say that thousands of people would be incapable of keeping the moon landing a secret if it didn't really happen. And that Hollywood obviously wouldn't be able to keep that a secret if they had been involved in it in any way whatsoever. There would be conclusive evidence. There would have been interviews. Lots of people would still be fucking talking about it. So it's unlikely that the first moon landing was faked, because we can kind of trace the number of people who claim to have been involved. Now, we can get into all sorts of conspiracies about what happened when they got up there, and there are plenty of them, ranging from the idea that there are alien military bases, that it's a redoubt for intergalactic travelers, that it's sort of a communication station that the aliens that are on Earth working with the United States government use to communicate with aliens in space, that it's in fact hollow, and Nazis have a base inside of it. That's another one that exists. So there's lots and lots and lots of weird shit people have said about the moon. And of course, there's been interviews with different astronauts who've alluded to things as well. And, you know, I don't know what to make of that whenever that happens. Whenever government employees and government officials come out saying things about having seen UFOs or having experience with extraterrestrials, I never know how seriously I'm supposed to take it, especially because we know, as we've discussed way back in the pilot season in the Bill Cooper episodes, episode 2, that the government on more than one occasion intentionally leaked bullshit about aliens and UFOs to the ufologist community because they knew they were feeding the conspiratorial minds of a bunch of crazy people, if I may be so bold. So they intentionally leaked misinformation to create and foment a paranoia in a community, which would then make the Soviets believe that they were working on all of this stuff, and there was this weirdo community of people who were finding bits and pieces of it. So there is, in fact, evidence that the government has pretended to leak documents, or, oh, this fell out of a copier in the case of Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. And it was intentional disinformation and propaganda. So the government's a tricky one. You know, we talked about this the other day, that it's very, very difficult to gauge whether they are profoundly evil or profoundly stupid sometimes. But in the case of the way they've handled the ufologist community since the 1960s, really, it's fair to say that we've been a community of useful idiots for the federal government on numerous occasions. And a lot of that intentional disinformation then gets picked up and grafted on to the secret space program conspiracy, like Majestic 12, the fake moon landing thing that we just talked about. There's a lot of these different, disparate, in much the way its later cousin QAnon would do with fucking every conspiracy ever. Anything related to outer space and extraterrestrials finds its way into the secret space program. The Men in Black, as a sort of, not paramilitary, but a muscle for the secret space program, and quieting and silencing anybody who learns too much about this program. Because, as I said before, in a foreshadowing for QAnon, with a lot of the people who push the secret space program, one of the functions of NASA is kidnapping children to feed them to aliens. So it feeds a lot of people's concern about child trafficking rings, something that would later go on to fuel Pizzagate and QAnon and every other goddamn thing that the right wing thinks now is based on something bad happening to children who aren't real in a place that doesn't exist. But with the secret space program, it ties in through this pipeline of children, and this has again been verified by Laura Eisenhower, who is allegedly the great-granddaughter of a president of the United States, for Christ's sake, that the federal government kidnaps children and gives them to NASA to teleport them to Mars to feed them to lizards. So that's a thing that apparently, according to like Gaia TV, 500,000 people believe. So I guess weep for your generation, America. Now, interestingly enough, the hollow moon hypothesis, or spaceship moon as it's known colloquially, is typically tied to the ancient astronaut and theory and UFOs, but it was first suggested by H.G. Wells in 1901 in the book The First Men in the Moon. So it's actually another thing that dates back over 100 years that people have been proposing for quite some time. The conversation also sort of corresponds to the Hollow Earth conversation, which, as we've discussed in the past, goes back to like the 1500s or 1600s. So there's a lot of conversation going back hundreds of years about the possibility that there's nothing in the middle of the planets. And we've only really known for a fact that there was since like the late 1900s. So it's not that strange that people have philosophies based around the idea that the moon is hollow. It's the part that they think that it's filled with Nazis that's a bit unusual, I guess. And the idea that the moon is actually a spaceship was first posited by the Soviets in the 1970s. Michael Vassin and Alexander Sherbakov of the Soviet Academy of Sciences put forth a hypothesis that the moon is a spaceship created by unknown beings. They did so in an article entitled, quote, "Is the Moon the Creation of Alien Intelligence?" Which was published in Sputnik, which is sort of a science fiction magazine from Soviet Russia. It was kind of like Reader's Digest, but about sci-fi stuff. The Vassin-Sherbakov hypothesis was later reported on here the following year. Their hypothesis relied heavily on the suggestion that large lunar craters, which were generally assumed to be formed from meteor impact, are generally too shallow and have flat or even convex bottoms. There were also, I should note, moonquakes recorded on the moon by seismographs whenever we went up during the Apollo missions. So the moon has not earthquakes, but moonquakes. The idea that these guys had was that small meteors are making a cup-shaped depression in the rocky surface of the moon, while the larger meteors are drilling through a rocky layer and hitting an armored hull underneath. The two men reference earlier speculation by astrophysicist Iosif Shklovsky, who suggested that the Martian moon Phobos was an artificial satellite and in fact hollow in the middle. This has since, of course, been shown not to be the case. I don't think we have any hollow planets, but someone can prove me wrong. Skeptical author Jason Colavito, who we've discussed in the past, points out that all of their evidence is circumstantial and that in the 1960s, the Soviet Union promoted the ancient astronaut concept in an attempt to undermine the West's ideas of religion. So a lot of these ideas were popular for political reasons and not because they made any sort of sense. In much the same way that there are often conspiracies in the secret space program community about both American and Nazi military bases on the moon and on Mars. It also ties into the New Swabia conspiracy that we discussed on Wednesday about Nazi bases or American military bases or American and alien cohabitated bases in Antarctica. There's also something that we haven't talked about on the show before called Operation High Jump, which was an American military expedition to Antarctica that took place in 1946. The operation was organized by Rear Admiral Richard Byrd, and both Byrd and High Jump are mentioned frequently in SSP lore as having encountered aliens and Nazis involved in something of a war whenever they got to Antarctica. After aiding in the battle with the aliens, allegedly, Admiral Byrd established a military base underground in Antarctica with the aliens, where we work in concert with aliens on alien technology. And also, one of the aspects of the SSP and something that happens at the base in Antarctica is the mining of something called Loosh, which is a manifestation of concentrated human emotional energy. This has evolved over the years in many conceptions of the secret space program conspiracy slash community, I guess, into adrenochrome. And to keep Earth safe from the aliens who want to steal our Loosh and or adrenochrome, the United States government developed a super soldier program. Now, there's some evidence that the U.S. military did actually try to create super soldiers. And of course, we've talked in the past about the Stargate Project. But the SSP has like an entire subdivision of people who claim that they are cybernetically or otherwise augmented by the United States government to fight intergalactic wars in outer space. People like Randy Kramer. Actually, Jake Angeli, the Q shaman who was arrested after January 6th, has like 10-hour videos on, or he did, on YouTube about how he was part of the secret space program and how he was used and augmented and taught how to astral project to fight ultra-terrestrials in other dimensions on behalf of the secret space program. So there is kind of a weird tradition amongst a lot of these people that they believe they were experimented on as children and then used as soldiers in a war against aliens. You know, not just these two cats, Andrew Basiago, who we've laughed about it at length in the past, Corey Good, who we're going to talk a little bit more about later, Laura Eisenhower, again, allegedly the great-granddaughter of a president of the United States, all claim to have been taken as children, experimented on, and used by the secret space program. And these accounts often include elements from the Montauk Project, such as time travel, de-aging technology, human enhancement, these kinds of things. All of this shit is just science fiction. That's part of what made researching this so difficult, because all of the books written about a lot of this stuff are just sci-fi books about alien channeling and teleportation and time travel, and I saw the president get shot 6 times, and all this other ridiculous shit that's clearly just odd conjecture and conjecture and conspiratorial thinking and storytelling, alternative thought, masquerading as, like, imagine right now you woke up and someone told you Star Wars actually happened. That's what this is. It's a bunch of dudes who have either convinced themselves or realized that there is a lot of money in telling people that they are space warriors who fight aliens in outer space. And that somehow is valid to, again, according to Gaia TV, 500,000 goddamn people. So that's great, I guess. I mentioned Randy Kramer a second ago, and I feel like he's probably the best example of the super soldier conspiracy. So Randy says that he was taken at age 4 and trained as part of something called Project Moonshadow, which is part of something called the Mars Defense Force. Apparently, time travel and de-aging were used to cover his absences when he went on missions. And at age 17, Kramer says he was recruited to protect civilian settlements on Mars. This was in 1987, by the way. So we had at least 5, according to Randy Kramer, human settlements on Mars. He says that he served with the MDF for 17 years and was then de-aged and returned so that no one would know he was missing. So basically, it's just Starship Troopers with time travel plus the Montauk Project. In a similar vein, Robert David Steele, another noted lunatic, has claimed that Mars is inhabited by human slave colonies that were basically there to maintain colonies and as a food source, presumably for alien lizards. So that's another aspect of the secret space program is bases in Antarctica, bases on the moon, bases on Mars. We're food for aliens who also mine louche. I'll go on. Probably one of the most public faces, if there is one, of the secret space program is a man named David Wilcock. And while you'd probably be most likely to recognize him from Ancient Aliens, or if you're familiar with Gaia TV, he's had a relationship with Gaia TV going back a really long time. But there's not a lot available about David Wilcock, so I thought, because there's no way it wouldn't be hilarious, we would read David's bio about himself from his website. So I have that here for you now. This is from 2006, A Brief History of David's Experiences. Now, mind you, he wrote this. Ever since age 2, David remembers having dreams of massive metallic cylinders floating in the sky, along with bizarre synchronicities during the day. At age 5, David had a spontaneous out-of-body experience that greatly crystallized his quest for the truth of ESP, metaphysics, and consciousness. So already, in this guy's bio about himself, he says he was starting to ask questions about ESP and metaphysics at age 5. At age 7, David read his first full-length adult paperback book about ESP, entitled How to Make ESP Work for You by Harold Sherman. He conducted successful telepathic experiments with his friends and demonstrated repeated psychic accuracy while still in second grade, culminating in a classroom demonstration of his abilities. Okay. David's parents divorced whenever he was 11, and he quickly began gaining weight through emotional eating, trying to stuff his pain with food. As he got larger, he started wearing black t-shirts to try to hide his weight and became increasingly socially isolated. He reached his heaviest and most depressed point at age 15. At age 16, David committed to a weight loss plan and soon had the first of an ongoing series of lucid dreams, consciously induced through a technique he learned in Dr. Stephen LeBerg's book, Lucid Dreaming. He lost 85 pounds by strict dieting during this year of his life, going from 225 down to 140. Perhaps 20 or so of those pounds were in his hair alone. You've got to admit he cleans up good. There's a picture of him at age 15 and a picture of him at age 17. And in one, he has long hair and he's wearing a Metallica t-shirt. And in the age 17 picture, he looks kind of like a young Ben Shapiro. I guess that's the better picture, apparently. I sit here with long hair and a black t-shirt, so I might be biased. David's grades also improved along with his self-esteem as a result of losing so much weight. The day he cut his hair, people were stopping dead in their tracks when they saw him in the hallways. Good God, dude. His transformation so impressed the faculty of Scotia Glenville High School that David was awarded the Martin J. Mahoney Memorial Award for Personal and Academic Progress. Fair enough. At age 19, after one bleary-eyed year of college partying, David went totally sober and began a detailed journal of all of his dreams on a daily basis. So what I'm hearing is you had one emotionally distressed year at age 15, and you stopped drinking at age 19. So you've just been kind of a boring dork your entire life, haven't you? Anyway, he has an unbroken record of dreams that continue to this day, some 14 years later. Currently, David averages 80 to 100 pages of this private journal writing every 15 days, between documenting dreams, important emails, and life's daily events. David considers meditative journaling and dream work to be essential to spiritual growth. Is that supposed to be a flex? You write 100 pages a month? I write 90 pages of notes a week for this show. I am not impressed by your dream journaling. Anyway, David later graduated from the State University of New York at New Paltz with a BA in psychology and a master's equivalent in experience from his internship at a suicide hotline, completing his formal education at age 22. David's, quote, graduate studies with higher intelligence, that's in capitals, had already begun at age 20 by fully reading and absorbing an average of 3 metaphysical books per week. He integrated over 300 metaphysical titles between 1993 and 1995. Now, I think that's very interesting. I'm gonna take a break for just 1 second to point this out. I noticed that it doesn't say he read books. It says that he integrated or absorbed metaphysical information. Not that he studied this shit and read a whole bunch of things, that he absorbed the information. I think that's interesting, especially when you get to the stuff about Edgar Cayce. David's internet research began in 1996 and soon replaced books as the predominant medium of study. Though internet writing is often lower in quality than published books, it also contains much that cannot be found in libraries and bookstores, and the search functions are irreplaceable. We now have 9 feet worth of books from printed website articles, which David organized with a binding machine. This massive archive has spawned all 3 Convergence, sorry, that's all in capitals, books published freely on this site, with book 3, Divine Cosmos, being the most sophisticated in content and in writing style, hence the new name of the website. This archive also spawned part 3 of The Reincarnation of Edgar Cayce, and the material for a trilogy of Convergence films. And we're still only using a small portion of what we uncovered, though we do feel it is the best portion, the most inspiring and scientifically sound. Scientifically sound, he says. Wilcox's preliminary direct contact with higher intelligence was through a quick burst of automatic writing, which occurred at age 22 in November of 1995. A very small number of characters gave a Bible citation that was highly synchronistic and meaningful to David at that time, even though he had never studied the Bible. 3 years of daily dream work and intense metaphysical research helped tune his mind to receive this one brief message. However, there was still another year of work to be done before it could come through sustainably. In verbal form. During this year, only dreams came through. No further messages or sentences. This automatic writing experience paved the way for David to begin reading the Raw material, R.A. Raw, the Law of One series in January of 1996, channeled by LL Research based in Louisville. They've apparently been in Louisville since 1983. The Law of One integrated and explained all 300 books worth of David's metaphysical research and his 3 years worth of esoteric dreamer research so well that he felt as if it had been written for him. It also seemed to clearly be implying that a major change, literally a dimensional shift, was coming to the Earth in the not-too-distant future. David was dazzled to discover that no one had ever written a book about the science of the Law of One series before, and he began writing some articles on Richard Hoagland's discussion board in the summer of 1996. In November of 1996, at age 23, David broke through to direct verbal contact with his own higher self, thanks to the tuning provided by the Law of One study and the ongoing daily dream work. This proved to be the most important single event of David's entire life, and it utterly changed everything, taking all the outside studies and suddenly making them intensely personal. The source showed that it was outside of time and could accurately predict events before they happened with great precision, and it was also a fount of unending wisdom regarding how David could further grow spiritually. He had a lot more work to be done, in releasing fear, increasing responsibility, developing his new scientific models, etc. In September of 1997, David was told in a consciously induced OBE to move to Virginia Beach, Virginia. As soon as David arrived in Virginia Beach, many ARE people recognized him as the spitting image of a young Edgar Cayce. It should be noted that the ARE do not recognize David as the reincarnation of Edgar Cayce at all, and in fact have released a statement specifically saying that they wanted to distance their organization from UFO people like David. Anyway, then in November of 1997, after considerable speculation from self and others, David confronted his source directly about the possibility of having been Edgar Cayce in a past life. The source said that, in short, the answer is yes, and with this knowledge comes great responsibility, because not only are you Edgar Cayce, you're fucking Spider-Man. And other than the start of the channeling itself, this was by far the greatest surprise of David's entire life. It was extremely difficult for him to accept this, it doesn't sound like it was, but the readings insisted that he talk about it with others and spread the word. So I don't know that I'm comfortable with, and I don't want to comfortable with this, and I don't want to brag, but the spirits that I talked to told me that I really need to tell everybody that I meet that I'm the reincarnation of this dead mystic from the 19th century. Anyway, they also insisted that he either begin doing readings professionally and publish books for free online, or he would completely lose his ability. So, if you're following that, the spirits told David he needed to start charging people money for this shit, or he wasn't going to be able to do it anymore. How advantageous for David is that? Beginning in July of 1998 and ending in August of 2005, David conducted 500 paid personal readings as a full-time professional intuitive counselor. David's first stab at a convergence volume was published on the Great Dreams website in spring of 1998, and David's own website, Ascension 2000, came online in February of 1999. In parentheses, no content has been deleted from this website since its inception, though we did change the name. The first complete volume of Convergence was posted on March 8th, 1999, on Wilcox's 26th birthday. The second volume was completed in late 2000, the first volume largely rewritten in 2001, and the third and most important volume, Divine Cosmos, in April of 2002. The reincarnation of Edgar Cayce finally hit bookstores nationwide in 2004, though most of David's work on the book was completed in 2003. The book was edited through at least three different passes by David, though he did not suppress any material that may have cast him in an unfavorable light, I'll bet. Only striving to increase readability and round out the supporting data. Reincarnation became the third best-selling book in the entire Frog Books catalog, though consistently left in a foul-smelling cloud of dust by Walter the Farting Dog. So, that's David Wilcock. We'll get back to him in a minute. But I've mentioned several times that he believes he is the reincarnation of a man named Edgar Cayce. And I'm sure a lot of you are probably wondering, who the fuck is Edgar Cayce? So, Edgar Cayce claimed that he could channel his higher self while sleeping, and in his sleep, he would reach this trance state in which he would discuss things like reincarnation, nutrition, Atlantis, and evangelical Christianity, and then his wife would write down the things that he said. He also believed that he tapped into what was, as far as he understood it, a shared human conscience, and that he could tap into this while sleeping. Now, this is actually very, very similar to a phenomenon called the sleeping preacher, which was very, very common amongst Protestant Christians who believed that they could tell prophecies in a dream or trance-like state, going back to the 16th century in Germany. Immediately after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in 1685, a resistance movement broke out among the persecuted French Protestants in southern France. The movement in which trance preaching was relatively widespread is known as the Prophet Movement, also known as the Commissards. It eventually spread to England in 1706 and to Germany and Switzerland in 1711, where its adherents took the same took on the name the True Inspirationalists. There's also like a huge tradition of this in the Amish and Mennonite communities. One of the most famous sleeping preachers of all time, probably Noah Troyer, was from an Amish community in Washington State. But there's been a tradition of people who claimed to receive divine inspiration by taking a nap that goes back literally to like the 1500s. So, Cayce's childhood seems to have been equally occupied by church and the supernatural. He said that he believed that he spoke to ghosts and he would receive special messages from spirits. He also said that he learned by sleeping on top of books and absorbing the information in the books by sleeping on them. According to his biographer, Cayce was struck in the head by a ball and was able to diagnose and cure himself after being given instructions in a dream by spirits. You see here ties to like Christian Science and mesmerism and the ideas of concentrating to self-diagnose and treat yourself. Cayce said that he read the Bible once a year, every year, and that he talked to dead people, the angels, and saw auras. After a particularly bad bout of laryngitis, for a time, Cayce lost the ability to speak, so he said. Unless he was in a trance state, he could only speak whenever he was in one of these trances. Cayce was eventually hypnotized and given a hypnotic suggestion that his voice worked again, and then, wouldn't you know who won the fucking pony, his voice worked again. Cayce claimed that he had given over 8,000 readings by 1922, and a total of 14,306 transcripts of his readings are available. Cayce also claimed that he was a medium, a prophet, he could astral project, and he's one of only like three or four people who claimed that they could read the Akashic Records, which were, or are, depending on whatever your opinion about Theosophy is, a compendium of all universal events, thoughts, words, emotions, and intent ever to have occurred or ever will occur of all human and non-human entities. These records can't be reached on the physical plane. They're supposed to only be able to be reached by clairvoyance through things like astral projection. Helena Blavatsky referred to the Akashic Records, which is a term she never actually used herself, as indestructible tablets of astral light. So, Joseph Smith's golden tablets given to him by angels, except these ones only exist in your head. Which alleviates the need to prove to anyone that they're real, because they're a non-physical record. So that's actually smart. Casey, as a guy who diagnosed things in his sleep and believed that he had access to magical records that he could only read in his dreams, gave psychic readings to Thomas Edison, Woodrow Wilson, and George Gershwin, among other famous, recognizable people. And he claimed, before he died in 1945, that he would reincarnate in 1998 at the beginning of the age of Aquarius. And you'll note, 1998 is the year that the spirits told David Wilcock he had to start charging people money for psychic readings or he wouldn't be psychic anymore. So that's a weird bit of synergy, or some asshole read a book and decided to say that he was the reincarnation of a dead mystic. Whatever.
And Wilcock has sort of been a spokesperson for Gaia TV since 2011. Maybe not a spokesperson, but one of the most prominently featured people on the network. Gaia, for those of you who don't know, is essentially what would have happened if InfoWars fucked the New Age movement and the baby turned into Netflix. It's been around since the 80s. A lot of people probably aren't aware of that. But it's now a video streaming service with its own platform behind a paywall that covers everything from transcendental meditation to MK Ultra to plandemic conspiracies to the deep state to a bunch of UFO shit to astrology, pseudo-archaeology, alchemy, mysticism, kundalini, alternative medicine, nutrition, and of course George Nori is also on Gaia TV, which should tell you the quality of programming on Gaia TV, because I don't know if I mentioned this whenever we talked about Coast to Coast AM on the Conspiracy Radio episode of the show, but George Nori's a fucking hack and everything he does is terrible. So that should give you an idea of the sort of company that David Wilcock keeps. There's not a lot available online about Gaia TV, those of you who aren't familiar. Essentially, it is a TV network that combines meditation and yoga practice with conspiratorial content and features people like David Wilcock, another gentleman named Jordan Maxwell, who I watched do a video about the secret of the American dollar, which is just that zeitgeist thing, but done for, I guess, your grandparents who watch the conspiracy Netflix. And in this video where Jordan Maxwell explains the secrets of the American dollar, he tells us that the dollar has a pyramid on it. And pyramid is a compound word made up of two other words, pyra and mid, meaning fire and middle. And that's a reference to genitalia, which is why there's a triangle on every men's room door you go in. There isn't. And also that the eye above the pyramid is on the dollar, because an eye is round like a ball is round, and the other thing that's round is Stonehenge. So there's a reference to Stonehenge on the American dollar. Oh, and also your social security card is supposed to be evidence that the Vatican owns you because the United States government borrowed money from Britain to start the Federal Reserve. And here's the thing. That's dumb fuck and crazy, and 500,000 people think that man was a genius. So it's concerning, and it's also creating a media atmosphere for people like the jackasses on Ancient Aliens to populate, where there is no potential for, oh, this is the craziest thing on television, so I'm going to watch this as a form of entertainment or something like that. No. It's everything in the programming reflects this conspiratorial worldview where nothing is what it is on the surface. Everything has these deeper meanings, and all of the deeper meanings are horseshit based on a pseudoscientific understanding of history, which is just wrong most of the time. So, Gaia TV caters to this new demographic of New Age, ooh-woo, yoga moms, basically, and introduces them to things like the Plandemic, and David Icke, and David Wilcock, and a lot of other people who are affiliated with Ancient Aliens, like Corey Good, another person who believes that he was augmented by the federal government and used in exopolitical, not debate, but he was a representative of the planet Earth in an intergalactic council of some sort. All of these people have delusions of grandeur and very, very active imaginations. Let's start there. And really, in any other context, and probably any other time period other than this one, all of this stuff wouldn't be harmless. It would just be ridiculous people doing a play pretend in their basements. But because of what's happened in adjacency to this, and really not just in adjacency to this, because people like David Wilcock have done a lot to advance the deep state conspiracy by blending things like crop circles and alien abduction theories with the idea that the federal government is working for the Illuminati to stop you from becoming fully enlightened by helping aliens mine your emotional energy for food. So it sounds stupid and harmless, but this is a feeding trough for QAnon. And as an evolution of the grift, David Wilcock, in a film that he released in conjunction with a few other of these space weirdos a couple of years ago, posited the theory that part of why we haven't had alien invasions here is because Donald Trump's great-grandfather was friends with Nikola Tesla, and they helped develop technology that's been keeping the Earth safe. So there is this QAnon-adjacent stuff where Trump is like an Avenger who's trying to keep the world safe from intergalactic warfare through his genetics, I guess. And apparently one of his relatives was friends with Nikola Tesla. Somehow I doubt that, but that's the story anyway. And here you see this connection between the alien space weirdo community and the QAnon Trump deep state community that has been a worrisome connection since, like, well, 2016, really. 2015, somewhere around there, right around whenever QAnon started popping up, and a 30% of the American population decided that a lunatic who eats Big Macs with a knife and a fork is actually James fucking Bond. And David Wilcock paints with bullshit the way some artists paint with oils. I mean, his narrative manages to tie together a lot of disparate angles of the conspiratorial right wing. I mean, in his writing alone, you have the New World Order, you have reptilians, you have the secret space program conspiracy and how it ties into the New Age movement theosophy and lots of other things. You have the idea that we are it's also tied into Christian eschatological beliefs in that the world is about to experience a cataclysmic event event and we need to be prepping in order to get ready for it. And you can pay the guy $500 for a prepper course that he'll teach you on how to get ready for the world to end. So there's lots of different aspects and corners of the conspiratorial right wing that find their meeting points in this guy, who again you can see on Ancient Aliens, a program on the History Channel, which is owned by Rupert Murdoch, who also owns Fox, and I'm sure that in no way are those two things related. Just a simple look at David's website, you find references to all kinds of fun nuggets in the conspiratorial ufologist community. For example, there's an all caps post on David Wilcox's website right now referencing Bob Lazar. I don't know how many of the audience are familiar with Bob Lazar, but we've never talked about Bob on the show because Bob is a crackpot and there's not really much of a reason to, but because it's fun and we're having a loose episode today, let's talk about Bob. So Bob claims to be an MIT physics graduate and a Caltech electronics graduate. There is no record whatsoever of him having attended either of those universities. He also graduated in the bottom third of his class in high school, so it's not likely that Bob went to both MIT and Caltech and graduated. Regardless, Bob claims to have been a physicist at Los Alamos Physics Facility. Los Alamos denies this, saying that Lazar, or Lazar, was a technician hired through a temp agency. Since 1989, Bob has been giving interviews claiming that he helped reverse engineer a UFO at a secret military base in Groom Lake. Lazar claims that flying saucers, which he calls the sports model, are made out of a substance similar to liquid titanium. He also claims that he was employed by the U.S. Navy via private contractor EG&G. EG&G has no record of employing him, ever. Bob also claims that he worked on an antimatter reactor, an antimatter reactor that ran on an element that doesn't exist. Lazar ties his bullshit into the Philadelphia experiment and the Montauk Project by discussing UFO technology for bending light to achieve invisibility. Lazar says he's worked on force fields, gravity beams, and that he has personally seen documents confirming the existence of gray aliens. And actually, at one point in this guy's cockamamie story, he claims that he saw two scientists at work talking to a gray alien at a fucking water cooler. A scene that I'm pretty sure inspired that Seth Rogen piece of shit where he plays an alien that's entirely done in CGI. What the hell was that called? Ned? Or Ed? Or whatever the hell? Anyway, I'm pretty sure that was inspired by Bob Lazar's story. He also says that his employment and education records have been erased and that he's been disavowed as part of a cover-up. So conveniently, even though Bob has all of these pedigrees and has worked at all of these places, all of which claim to have no idea who the fuck he is, that's because there's a secret cover-up that has erased any record of him having been anywhere that he says that he's been. It's awesome how all of these guys conveniently have explanations for why no one who should know who they are knows who they are. You know, oh, well, you say that they say that I never skipped school whenever I was part of the Mars Defense Force. Well, that's because I was de-aged and then time traveled back to the exact moment that I was taken, you know, like the Infinity Stones, so no one would ever notice that I was missing. So, haha. Yeah, you know, this is exactly like how I felt whenever I heard that the reason that there are multiple things that didn't really sound like the same thing were the same thing was because they were all really shapeshifters. It just sounds like a bullshit thing you came up with because you have no way to justify your lies that you're using to make money. And again, all of this really comes down to making money. Every single one of these motherfuckers is teaching a class or charging for interviews or being booked at UFO conventions to say this shit in public or is selling. David Wilcock has a $530 entry fee to a mystery school that he runs. A mystery school. You can buy a ticket to a mystery school. How mysterious could it be if all you need to get in is $530? It's really hard to not condescend to all of this stuff. So I guess that's why I'm condescending to all of this stuff on David Wilcox's website, to get back to it, I guess. He also references Valiant Thor, which is super advantageous because I almost did an episode about Valiant Thor this week, but I kind of decided there wasn't enough about Valiant Thor to fill an entire hour, so I can talk about Valiant Thor because of David Wilcox, and I don't have to worry about not being able to get an hour out of Valiant Thor. So, those of you who aren't aware of Valiant Thor other than the band, Thor was maybe an alien, maybe from Venus, who might have lived at the Pentagon in the 50s. He's first mentioned by a man named, and I'm going to have a lot of difficulty not laughing about this every time it comes up, Dr. Frank Stranges. So Dr. Strange is who came up with the idea of Valiant Thor. He was an evangelical Christian ufologist who said that Jesus, like Valiant Thor, came from the planet Venus. Allegedly, Valiant Thor arrived on Earth on March 15th, 1957. As the story goes, a UFO landed in Arlington, Virginia. Valiant Thor stepped out and, I shit you not, asked police to take him to their leader. Thor, I guess, was taken to the Pentagon, because apparently that's how national security works. A dude shows up in a park and says, I want to meet the president, so you take him to the Pentagon. Anyway, he then bypassed the entire Pentagon security by using telekinesis and proceeded to communicate with heads of the U.S. military using telepathy. Valiant Thor, or Dr. Strange, if you'd rather, said that he was a member of the Council 12, who are representatives from other planets who used Thor to maintain order in the galaxy, and he had been sent to Earth because of a fear of nuclear war. So the government managed to learn nothing about Venus or Valiant Thor, besides the fact that he was a Christian and a personal friend of Jesus Christ, and so are most races on most planets. I think it's wild that the evangelical Christian ufologist heard that space is full of Christians. It's weird how that's just a strange convenience there. Anyway, Valiant Thor was supposed to have met with Dwight Eisenhower, who just, apparently, in the short period of time that he was in office, met every goddamn alien who came into the solar system. He offered Eisenhower advanced alien technology in exchange for halting the production of nuclear weapons. He was unsuccessful in this, but he still helped build Area 51, apparently. So, according to descriptions of Valiant Thor, because we do have a physical description of Valiant Thor from, again, Doctor Strange, Thor had no fingerprints and no navel, and he was apparently 490 goddamn years old. He spoke 100 languages and had an IQ, dubious, of 1200. He could also teleport, and if you looked really closely, he was kind of purple. So that's what Thor looked like. He also apparently, again, helped facilitate the Grenada Agreement, which halted an immediate and an imminent invasion of the planet Earth. After not being able to convert the planet to Christianity or stop the threat of nuclear war, allegedly Valiant Thor went back to Venus, and we don't know what happened after that. But this guy, again, named Dr. Stranges, wrote a book called Stranger in the Pentagon, about a guy named Valiant Thor, who was almost 500 years old and a friend of Jesus from Venus. And now that's just part of ufologist lexicon, I guess. And that's a weird thing about what I alluded to earlier, in that a lot of this stuff just seems to be science fiction, because past a certain point, it's hard to tell how much of this was intentionally created for the purposes of this is a real thing that's going on, and how much of it was intended to be entertainment. Because it seems like a tendency, particularly with things related to the secret space program, is taking stuff that is quite literally just fiction and suggesting, and I guess this is a way that you can see the theosophical underpinnings of the secret space program, suggesting that these things that are fictional are real, or allusions to real things, or references to real things, or this person didn't know they were talking about a real thing. And unlike when we're talking about, you know, pseudo-geography, like with Lemuria or Atlantis, in this case, the thing that you didn't know was a real thing was, again, Star Wars. So there's lots and lots of figures other than just David Wilcock and, you know, Laura Eisenhower and the people we've discussed that are involved in this grift as well. There's also Mark Richards, who... this is going to be difficult to explain. Mark Richards is in prison for accessory to murder because he convinced a 17-year-old kid to murder someone who owed him money as part of a larger terrorist plot to blow up a bridge and declare himself king of a town in California based on a message that was apparently given to him by extraterrestrials. Mark prefers to be referred to as Captain Mark because he is the captain of a spaceship that only listens to him, that is sentient, that he astral projects to and goes on missions with as part of the secret space program, even though he's in prison for life for murder. So, as you can see, there's a lot of reputable people with no possible ulterior motives for any of this stuff. And of course, all of the people who want to help fund Mark Richards send money to Mark's wife, a woman that he met while he was in prison and got married to, who I'm assuming is living off of money that she gets from people who see her story on YouTube and believe that she is the wife of a decorated war hero who's been fighting aliens in other dimensions for the past 25 years. From a cell in prison, I guess. And then from there, the grift stratifies. You've got people like Michael Sala, who's real heavy on Nazi Antarctica military bases and the construction of UFOs as part of a secret government space program. You've got Kerry Cassidy, who's very, very big on stories about the alien sphere alliance and the blue avians and the reptilians and the reptoids. And there's 12 different species of aliens that orbit the Earth, and they have a galactic alliance that we're in concert with through the UN or the fucking Defense League or whatever the fuck. Like, there's so many people who just sort of have alternative thought experiments on camera for money, and a lot of them, like I said, eventually shifted the narrative in such a way that it incorporates plandemic, QAnon, because the grift has to keep going, and people have short attention spans, so this stuff just evolves. We have, I think, largely in part to Alex Jones, created an information space for people whose entire function is lying to you to make money, and not in the way that the mainstream news lies to you to make money. This is less about sponsorships and more about, here, I'm going to teach you how to survive the alien apocalypse. Just send me $500 to my Cash App. And in that, I think the secret space program is part of an ongoing tradition of things that we cover on this show that are stupid but extraordinarily dangerous. And that's today's episode, everybody. This was a traverse down a landslide of bullshit that I hope you enjoyed listening to more than I enjoyed researching. Because like I said, most of this isn't in books, it's on videos. So you have to watch these lunatics talk for hours to get this stuff. You know, I listened to a woman discuss how whales, fairies, and dolphins came from another planet in another dimension, and that's why they look so magical when you see it's like a Lisa Frank or what's the fucking, yeah, Lisa Frank. It's like one of her full binders came, like a Lisa Frank Trapper Keeper came to life and someone developed a cosmology around it. And that's the fun side of the SSP. The other side is wet sandwiches like David Wilcock, who believe that they're the reincarnation of dead spiritualists and spout off continuously about Nazi lore and nonsense from turn-of-the-century science fiction novels like it's real. And somehow that got him on television, which I think should concern more people. You know, that's... I've found myself saying that a lot this season, that... So here's the thing, and it should worry you, and I don't understand why it doesn't. Like, for example, here's a cat who is probably 2 to 3 people removed from politicians who are in contention to be president of the United States, who believes that he has magical powers that he inherited because he's the reincarnation of a dead mystic from the 19th century who thought that he could diagnose people's ailments while he was sleeping. That's insane, and I don't know how else to frame that. But here we are, and that person is presented to you on at least 4 different TV shows, not including the nonsense on Gaia TV, as an academic expert in a field of what, I don't know, but apparently that you just get to say you're an expert, and that makes you an expert these days. And having said that, I am Moxie O'Brien, an expert in the history of bullshit. So I hope you enjoyed today's episode, and we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. On Monday, we're going to begin our spooky season on the show, and I think we're going to have a conversation about the Malleus Maleficarum. So if you have any interest in weird witch lore, we'll be doing a bit of that next time on the show. But until then, concentrate on the hep, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See, and I will catch all of you beautiful people on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
Finished.